Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, then those buried in Palestine, then everyone else. Some Jews also thought their martyrs would rise before everyone else too. Matthew even says many saints rose on the day Jesus died, obviously before the resurrection of everyone else, another example of the Jewish idea of a staged resurrection. And of course, as we already saw, the Gospels attest to the belief that John might arise from the dead before the general resurrection, as well as the belief that Elijah or even some other prophet would rise early, heralding the approach of the end. But it's notable that the first expected to rise in one scheme was Adam, which might explain why Christ was regarded as the final Adam. Either way, the idea of a multi-staged resurrection formed the basis of Paul's apologetic for why Jesus rose before everyone else. Quote, "In Christ all will be made alive, but each in his own order. Christ the first fruits, then those who belong to Christ, at his coming, and then comes the end." End quote. That Paul regarded Christ as the first fruits entails he believed the resurrection of Jesus was the first stage of the general resurrection, for the first fruits were always the first sheaf of grain in one general harvest. And in like fashion, Paul emphasizes that the resurrection must take place in the proper order. Thus, Paul, like many other Jews, believed the general resurrection would come in stages, so the resurrection of Jesus would, and did, indicate the general resurrection had begun, which is why Paul appears to have expected the end to come in his own lifetime. Was there a better idea? So there was no barrier here either. Many Jews were prepared to accept that a Christ might rise from the dead before the rest of Israel. However, Holding does raise a more nuanced argument. Quote, "A physical resurrection was completely unnecessary for merely starting a religion," he says, "since it would have been enough to say that Jesus' body had been taken up to heaven like Moses's or like Elijah's," end quote. Of course, this argument requires supposing Jesus was fictional. If it is the case that Jesus was executed and buried, as the Gospels say, then resurrection was the only claim available, since an actual public death and burial would prevent any other claim being made. In other words, if everyone knew Jesus was dead, then Christians could only claim he ascended to heaven by also claiming he rose, in some sense, from the dead. But even if Holding can wriggle out of that conundrum, there are three other important problems with his last argument. The first problem with this argument is that it suffers from a common flaw in counterfactual history. It assumes only the easiest and most persuasive ideas win out. History decisively refutes such a notion. A great many zany ideas have gained widespread purchase and endured for centuries. For example, requiring castration to enter the priesthood was completely unnecessary for the success of the Attis cult, since it would have been enough to have, say, some sort of symbolic castration instead, exactly like Paul's device of replacing the true circumcision with a spiritual one, even calling that the better one. But they didn't. And yet the cult flourished, at least as well as Christianity did in its first 100 years. In like fashion, in later Christian history, Unitarianism was easier to sell than Nicene Trinitarianism, since Unitarianism, as championed, for example, within Arianism, was less convoluted and left fewer opportunities for attack and criticism. Yet the church sided with the latter despite having to expend vast resources and foster tremendous strife and violence to win the argument. So religions often succeed by starting out or sticking with the position harder to defend. The second problem with this argument is that it assumes there was no other reason for choosing the more difficult sell. As we've already seen, there were reasons why many people, among both Jews and Gentiles, wanted to believe in a resurrection, either by raising the flesh or gaining a superior body like heroes and demigods. Those were the people who joined up, and many eventually formed the Sarcist sects of the Christian church. Their reasons for believing something regarded as so odd by various others had more to do with their particular desires and expectations, and disdain for lofty philosophical systems, than with their being convinced by a decisive presentation of empirical evidence, a point I'll talk about in later chapters. But the first, and this second problem, negate Holding's argument because Christianity's success was not at all remarkable until the late 3rd century. Before then, it was a struggling minority cult. Indeed, it barely even blipped on the radar of Roman society before the age of Trajan. I'll demonstrate that in chapter 18. Here it's enough to note that, When the evidence was still theoretically checkable and therefore relevant to Holding's case, Christianity only won a tiny fraction of the hearts and minds of the Greek, Roman, and Jewish world. That kind of humble success does not require Christianity to have been the most sellable product since the invention of beer. As long as it would sell at all, as long as a tiny fraction of the evangelized groups would find it attractive, and we've shown they would, then Christianity would succeed on the scale we actually observe for that first century, just as the cult of Attis did. And we can certainly say that requiring men to hack off their testicles is a far stronger deterrent than preaching a Christ risen in the flesh, an idea a great many people already accepted as plausible. Besides all the evidence already given, consider the second century remark of Justin Martyr, quote, "When we say that the Word, who is our teacher, Jesus Christ, the firstborn of God, was produced without sexual union, and that he was crucified and died and rose again and ascended to heaven, we propound nothing new or different from what you believe regarding those whom you consider sons of God," end quote. Justin could not make this argument if it wasn't true, which means even his own strictly Sarcist notion of resurrection was neither new nor different for pagans, refuting Holding's claim that it was. Holding might claim Justin is lying, but why should we believe that? Justin would not shoot himself in the foot by using an argument his pagan audience knew was baloney. For if Justin knew pagans would know this statement was false, why would he say it? Clearly he believed it would appeal to pagans and win his argument. Therefore it must have been true, true enough, not to make him look like a liar. But the third and most important problem with Holding's last argument is that it places the Gospels before Paul, when we know the order is the other way around. Holding says, quote, "It would have been enough to say that Jesus's body had been taken up to heaven," end quote, in order to get the religion started. Yet as it turns out, that appears to be exactly how it did start. Paul never makes any distinction between Christ's resurrection and ascension, and he also equates our resurrection with Christ's, and describes our resurrection as an ascension. Holding asks, why bother making the road harder? But clearly that's a question to ask for later Christians, not the Christians of Paul's generation, for maybe they didn't make it harder. And as we've already seen, those who later deviated from Paul by reconceiving Christ's resurrection as a revival of his divinely improved corpse, and then distinguished that event from his ascension, were not making the road harder. Rather, they were making it easier for their chosen target audience, the disgruntled, anti-elitist masses who were awash with stories of revived corpses and resurrected godmen appearing on earth. Though this did make it a harder sell to many educated elites and their allies and sympathizers, we see that Christianity already had a very hard time winning such people over, exactly as Holding's argument predicts. In contrast, those few elite intellectuals who eventually did convert and told us why do not give the account of their reasons that Holding wants. Rather than being overwhelmed by what we would call empirical evidence, they were simply dissatisfied with all the alternatives. I'll present this case in chapter 17. Conclusion. It's clear that, contrary to Holding's claims, a bodily resurrection, even of an individual, was not regarded as impossible by all pagans and Jews, but only by some of them. Indeed, for many, especially among those groups the Christians most successfully evangelized, such a resurrection was eminently credible and sometimes desired. Thus, Holding's argument fails even if we suppose the Gospels represent the original Christian belief, and we've seen reasons to suspect they do not. Chapter 4. Was the New Always Bad? James Holding argues next that, for the Romans, old was good, innovation was bad. And this was a big sticking point for Christianity, he says, because it could only trace its roots back to a recent founder. But that isn't really true. From the very beginning, in the letters of Paul, every Christian text aimed at persuasion connects Christianity intimately and profoundly with the Jewish scriptures, regarded even by pagans as among the most ancient oracles of man. Christianity never claimed to have been founded by Jesus. It always claimed that Jesus was merely the culmination of a divine plan that had been written down for millennia. For example, look at Romans 16, verse 25 to 26. By an ancient God, whose worship many Romans respected precisely because the Jewish religion could claim such great antiquity. Even Tacitus, notable for his loathing of the Jews, admits their religion was ultimately sanctioned by its antiquity, and the Roman state actually passed laws respecting the ancestral traditions of the Jews, which included protecting their scriptures from sacrilegious theft or vandalism. As Robin Lane Fox observes, quote, "Of the world's major religions, only Buddhism made a complete break with tradition at its birth. Christianity made no such claim. It could meet the traditionalist culture of pagan contemporaries on equal terms," end quote. Hence, Christianity was potentially respectable, so long as the Christian was given enough time to explain himself and his audience was open to such supernatural wonders as the Christian story contained, and was sympathetic to its anti-elitist ideals. Holding is right, however, that as long as Christianity appeared to be a complete innovation, too few would have accepted it, and as a result, it was often derided as novel by those who knew little about it. But as soon as anyone gave a Christian missionary the time of day, the appearance of novelty evaporated, and the cult then, and quite plausibly, claimed one of the most ancient and venerable origins of any known religion. As a result, Christianity was no more new to the Greeks and Romans than other novel foreign cults. These included Mithraism from Phrygia, and Manichaeism from Parthia, and the worship of Isis the Egyptian, Attis the Syrian, Antinous the deified lover of Hadrian, and Glaucon of Abunoticus, as well as any of the many emperor cults, particularly the most prevalent of them, the worship of the divine Augustus, which had priests and temples throughout the empire. And all the Greek schools of philosophy, Platonism, Epicureanism, Stoicism, Skepticism, Aristotelianism, Pythagoreanism, were not only novel when they were contrived, and yet phenomenally successful in the East, but both novel and foreign when introduced to Rome, and yet won her over as well. Even Acts reports that under Rome, all the Athenians and the foreigners living in Athens would spend their time in nothing but telling or hearing something new. And just like Seneca, whose own remarks I had quoted earlier in chapter 1, Tacitus only reveals the impotence of his disdain when he says essentially the same of Rome as Acts says of imperial Athens, that Christianity gained purchase in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. For all his protestation, Tacitus reveals the hard truth, that the, quote, hideous and shameful, end quote, was nevertheless popular, even in the very capital of the Roman Empire. And thus the Romans so frequently found ways to paint the new as old that an endless stream of novel cults and philosophies came to permeate every inch of the empire, even despite resistance from some among the elite, from Cato to Seneca to Juvenal, who found the unstoppable popularity of these novelties appalling. But unstoppable they were. So no appeal to a Roman resistance to the new can argue against the natural success of Christianity. If dozens of other new cults and philosophies could succeed in spite of this resistance, then so could Christianity. In fact, the most conspicuous elements of innovation in Christianity were its most popular features. It took the religion of Judaism, which was already winning converts from among the pagans, and made it even more attractive by making it far less onerous, as I explained in chapter 2. And it promised to subvert the most despised of elite values and produce an egalitarian utopia of justice for the common man, though for now only within the church. Of course, this would make it a loathsome superstition to most among the elite, and to many Jews, but among the disgruntled masses, Jew and Gentile alike, it could be exciting and attractive. The Christians even eliminated some of the worst complaints against Judaism that opponents like Tacitus leveled at it. For example, they abandoned the very laws Tacitus regarded as sinister and abominable, especially circumcision, and they abandoned the racism and insular group loyalty that Tacitus also singled out for derision. So Christianity could only have been an improvement in his view. In contrast, Holding is quite wrong to claim that Christian eschatology was new. Of course, it was entirely in accord with what most Jews had believed and taught for centuries, so Holding can only mean it appeared novel to pagans inexperienced with Jewish teachings. But this Jewish eschatology was clearly no barrier to winning over pagan sympathizers and even converts to Judaism, so it could not have been a problem for the Christian mission either. Moreover, the whole idea of sanctification, of an ultimate cleansing and perfecting of the world and each person, derives entirely from pagan Zoroastrianism. It had been a staple of Persian religious life and society for centuries, and had infiltrated Greco-Roman thought well before Christianity came along. We talked about this in Chapter 3. For instance, the doctrine of a cleansing cataclysm of fire that would renew the entire universe and purify human souls was a common belief among Stoics, and Romans were more attracted to Stoic philosophy than any other. And some Middle Platonists advocated the idea as well, and there is no evidence the masses rejected these ideas, so there was nothing new about this. Likewise, anyone acquainted with Christian literature, especially on the Garden of Eden, knows even the Christians believed the past was the best of times and things have gotten worse since then. They merely expected a cataclysmic improvement, but so did the Zoroastrians, many Stoics, and some Middle Platonists. The popular Greco-Roman concept was that everything would start over again, perfect, and play out again the same way, though perhaps with small variations. The Jews, following the original Persian scheme, merely tweaked this idea into a vision of a final material or heavenly paradise ruled by God, and the Christians simply borrowed that idea. Considering their target audience, this helped Christianity more than hurt it. The common man would have preferred this hopeful vision of the future to the obscure and depressing metaphysics of the despised elite, whose views could not claim anywhere near the same antiquity as those of the Jews or the Persian Magi. And Holding presents no evidence of hostility to Christian eschatology anyway, not even from the elite. In the end, Holding's argument that the Christian claim to antiquity still faced a hurdle that Christianity could never overcome outside a limited circle without some substantial offering of proof is far too strong. Christianity's difficulty here was no greater than that faced by any other novel cult or philosophy, and yet dozens of those saw success well beyond a limited circle. And Christianity often overcame this hurdle without any empirical proof, simply by applying the art of persuasion through learned scriptural exegesis, as I'll explain in Chapter 13. Arguing that they were the true Jews, faithful to the original and enduring vision of the Jewish God. In this respect, Christianity actually had an advantage over other cults and philosophies, which could not claim so ancient an oracular foundation. Chapter 5. Who would join a moral order? Pagans are moral people too. Every scholar of antiquity has noted the broad interest among the ancient Greeks and Romans in philosophies that promoted a strong moral order. Every great philosophy was morally demanding. In fact, that is precisely why they were as popular as they were. As Martha Nussbaum accurately puts it, quote, "The Hellenistic philosophical schools in Greece and Rome, Epicureans, Skeptics, and Stoics, all conceived of philosophy as a way of addressing the most painful problems of human life. They saw the philosopher as a compassionate physician whose arts could heal many pervasive types of human suffering. They practiced philosophy not as a detached intellectual technique dedicated to the display of cleverness, but as an immersed and worldly art of grappling with human misery." End quote. It's very easy to see, especially examining the letters of Paul, how Christianity fit itself into this paradigm like a glove. It was following in the footsteps of the most popular philosophical traditions of its own day, and improving them by answering the needs and desires of the lower classes, who far outnumbered the wealthy educated elite, and by abandoning the principles of doubt and free thought the Greeks and Romans had cultivated, replacing them with an absolute conviction and certainty that more people wanted instead. That's a point I'll examine further in Chapter 17. It's therefore strange to see Holding claim that Christian ethics were so restrictive that, quote, "it is very difficult to explain why Christianity grew," end quote, while Jewish converts and sympathizers remained a very small group. Though Gentile converts to and supporters of Judaism were not such a small group as he must think, the relevant fact here is that Christianity was far less demanding than Judaism, as I pointed out in Chapter 2. Thus, by Holding's own logic, it should have been far more attractive, hence far more successful in winning converts. And it was. It was a movement whose time had come. A moral vision of a just society was what most people in antiquity longed for. This was supposed to be provided by the laws and social customs, but those were failing due to corruption at the highest levels, and a growing chaos at the lower levels, As in every region, and especially the cities, different peoples with different customs increasingly mixed and came into conflict. Indeed, by the 2nd century AD, Roman society had actually codified two different systems of law, one for the rich and privileged, and one for everyone else. At the same time, the social and economic needs of everyone else were no longer being satisfied. Enter Christianity. As we've noted, even Tacitus observed how the Jews had created for themselves their own just society of caring for each other like a family. This fact was not lost on the people of the Roman world. Indeed, it was envied. And though for some, like Tacitus, that envy bred resentment, for others, like those Gentiles who supported or converted to Judaism, it brought longing. The Jewish Brotherhood was something many people wanted and would gladly have joined, if only it wasn't so hard to become and live as a Jew. Thus, Christianity succeeded precisely when it abandoned all those difficulties while retaining the ideology of justice and compassion that people most wanted. By making that easier to obtain, joining the Christian Brotherhood became an attractive option to many people who had become disappointed with the wider society. Yes, to obtain this, they had to give things up, including the more liberal sexuality of the age, but this was no greater a sacrifice than the ritual and economic demands placed on them by every other religious movement. In fact, for some, especially women, it was an easier demand to meet. Most pagan cults already required the same or similar sexual purity for limited times in order to join rituals that procured salvation in this world or the next. In a sense, Christianity merely increased the efficiency of this system. Whereas in some pagan cults, such rituals might have to be repeated on a regular basis to ensure protection, Christianity simply required a constant state of holiness, thus guaranteeing a constant state of security. For many people, this was less demanding economically and socially, since it was free and required no time-consuming ceremonies or pilgrimages. And for others, it was seen as a better guarantee against a horrible fate in this life or the next. And in exchange for this increased self-discipline, what they got was family, brotherhood, equity, justice. In short, the joys of community without the pains of the rat race, insulated from the tribulations of an uncertain and difficult world. Anyone who saw this trade as worthwhile would be inclined to join up. And those were the very people Christianity won over. As Robin Lane Fox says, quote, "The continuing spread of Christianity, therefore, was not only due to its offer of goods which pagan religiousness had never centrally comprised, it was also due to faults in pagan society. In cities of growing social divisions, Christianity offered unworldly equality. It preached, and at its best, it practiced, love in a world of widespread brutality. It offered certainty and won conviction, where the great venture of Greek philosophy was widely perceived to have argued itself into the ground. By 250 AD, it was still the persecuted faith of a small minority, but its progress was sufficient to reflect on a growing failure of the pagan towns." End quote. So Holding is wrong to suggest that Christianity would have been fatally unpopular because it, quote, "didn't offer nice drunken parties or orgies with temple prostitutes," end quote, but instead forbade those things. In actual fact, many pagans frowned upon exactly those things. It's hard to find any elite author regarding them with approval. Both drunkenness and sexual dissipation were far more often regarded with scorn. For example, the pagans regarded the Roman sage Musonius Rufus to be the greatest wise man in history, second only to Socrates, and yet Rufus preached essentially the same ethics as the Christians. There was a more liberal sexual ethic generally, more or less depending on the community, and to a lesser extent even among the elite. But Holding exaggerates it. It wasn't orgies and booze that most converts were giving up. Those who actually converted saw themselves as escaping the endless frustration, uncertainty, and financial expense of sexual politics, which many an individual was willing to give up to better his life and save his soul. Not everyone, but enough to account for the actual scale of early Christian success. Holding is also making a hasty generalization when he claims the poor would not care for Christian communist ideals if they couldn't spend that shared dough on their favorite vice. Such a statement pretends that all human beings are reprobates. History proves otherwise. Many great traditions of austerity and compassion have flourished, from Buddhism to the cynicism of Diogenes, without needing empirical proof of any divine miracle. It's true that Christianity probably did not win over any reprobates who were happy with their cursed lives, but like Buddhism, Cynicism, Marxism, it certainly did win over those who, like Justin Martyr, expected more out of life, or who, like Augustine, were tired of the misery of their own sins. And that describes a lot of people in antiquity, as it does today. Christians aren't perfect either. Of course, this may even concede too much. It's an obvious fact that most devout Christians don't really follow the moral restrictions of their faith. There is as much adultery and sin within the Christian community today as within any other group. And from what evidence we have of ancient Christianity as well as human nature generally, we have no reason to believe it was any different back then. Many people probably did think they could join Christianity and gain its benefits without paying their moral membership fee. And no doubt then, as now, many got away with that, even despite the best efforts of preachers like Paul to restrain the flock. In other words, Holding's argument assumes people could become Christian only by becoming morally austere, which is not true today and wasn't then. In the same fashion, especially by the end of the second century onward, the rich could, and many did, enter the Christian movement for the worldly advantages of power and prestige. There were fewer and fewer opportunities in pagan society for big men to lord it over others or enjoy the adoration of crowds, so the opportunity to enter such positions within a well-organized church hierarchy was probably sometimes seized for just that purpose. So too, for the control of church wealth, much in the same way that corruption has seeped into the power structure of every other communist state, where there are no rich people, where in fact the very idea is openly scorned, yet those in positions of authority nevertheless command a vast pool of wealth, and history proves they often behave little differently than if it were their own. Power not only tends to corrupt, but it lures. And once the church had any real power to offer, its allure would attract sinister men as easily as the church today attracts pedophiles, and for similar reasons. I don't wish to imply that this influx of the morally insincere from among the rich and the poor was the norm, only that it was certainly an inevitable factor in the rise of Christianity that any discussion of its success must take into account. The appeal of communism. But I shall restrict my consideration now only to morally sincere conversion. Even in that context, Holding is wrong to claim Christianity wouldn't have succeeded because, quote, it didn't encourage wealth, but sharing, end quote, since that was actually what made the movement popular, especially among those groups it most successfully recruited from. Both the Christians and the Essenes were riding a wave of communist utopian longing that had deep roots in Greco-Roman society, especially among those outside the power structure. The communist Essene communities were attractive for the very same reasons as Christianity. They exchanged uncertainty for security and loneliness for community, and traded the empty rewards of money and power for the more satisfying rewards of respect and compassion. The latter was even more true by the second century, when wealth increasingly became a burden, as municipalities compelled the rich to engage monstrous financial outlays in support of the community to the point of causing some wealthy families to actually flee or go bankrupt. In such an atmosphere, the prospect of instead giving up that wealth in exchange for the security of a religious brotherhood became increasingly attractive, especially when you would enjoy the fruits of that benefaction yourself as a member, and escape the backstabbing world of politics for the comfort of a worldwide friendship. After all, for many people, especially in troubled times, it becomes clear that their needs are far more important than any luxuries, and such needs could include the comfort of friendship and community, and equity and justice, besides the more obvious health and sustenance. So again, Holding is guilty of hasty generalization. He says Christianity would not appeal to the rich, because they would be directed to share their wealth. But this is too broad an assertion. Even if most of the wealthy would balk, and no doubt they did, there were still some who would actually find this attractive, especially considering the rewards being offered in this life and the next, and the troubled times they found themselves in. And this became more true in the second and third centuries, precisely when Christianity began to win more hearts among the wealthy elite. Which brings us finally to Holding's strange suggestion that Christianity would be hampered by the fact that it didn't appeal to the senses but promised pie in the sky. It should not need arguing that this was actually an asset, not a disadvantage. By literally promising the world, indeed everything anyone ever wanted, immortality, power, for example, 1 Corinthians 6, verse 3, freedom from disease and want, security from every injury and injustice, and most of all, the comfort of a profoundly loving society, Christianity had put a very alluring product on the market. Of course, any movement that could actually provide all those things here and now would win everyone's allegiance and in short order. But no such movement existed, so pie in the sky was the only thing anyone had to sell. Thus, it's true that a potential convert needed to be convinced Christianity really had this product in stock, but the real question is, what actually convinced those converts? I'll discuss that in chapter 13. For now, it's enough to note that this same promise was made by many other popular religions at the time, from the cults of Isis or Mithra to the Eleusinian or Bacchic mysteries, and people flocked to them in droves. In fact, a great many more people than came to Christianity in its first 3 centuries, without needing decisive empirical proof that they really had the goods. So it clearly didn't take much to convince people of that. In the end, the fact is that most people in the ancient world were miserable. Even at the top, there was some discontent, and there was much more within the middle class and most of all lower down the ladder. And apart from violent revolution, which, for example, the Zealots attempted, but that most wisely saw would always fail, human beings have always had, throughout history, only 2 strategies for coping with a life of misery and uncertainty. They can seek endless pleasure to dull the pain, or they can seek peace from their miseries by devoting themselves to a moral life of philosophy or religion. We see both strategies applied in the ancient world, across all social groups, as in every other age and culture. Christianity would have appealed to those most interested in the latter strategy. And that segment of society was certainly large enough to account for the entirety of Christianity's success within its first century, and the bulk of its success within its first 2 or 3 centuries. Just look at the writings of Tatian or Justin, as we'll talk about in chapter 13. Moral discontent was the very thing that led them to Christianity. Conclusion. Rodney Stark provides an excellent summary of my entire argument in this chapter. Stark explains how the moral demands of Christianity ensured that Christians would enjoy the company of morally sincere members, which made membership attractive to those who wanted to avoid the morally suspect. It also made the movement more effective in the beginning by warding off leeches and parasites and other corrupting influences, thus making Christianity appear more blessed and able to distribute emotional and material resources more fairly than most other social institutions of the day. Among Christians, you could feel safe and enjoy the emotional and material benefits of trust. Stark concludes that early Christian churches, quote, must have yielded an immense shared emotional satisfaction. Moreover, the fruits of this faith were not limited to the realm of the spirit. Christianity offered much to the flesh as well. It was not simply a promise of salvation that motivated Christians, but the fact that they were greatly rewarded here and now for belonging. Thus, while membership was expensive, it was in fact a bargain. That is, because the church asked much of its members, it was thereby possessed of the resources to give much. For example, because Christians were expected to aid the less fortunate, many of them received such aid, and all could feel greater security against bad times. Because they were asked to nurse the sick and dying, many of them received such nursing. Because they were asked to love others, they in turn were loved. And if Christians were required to observe a far more restrictive moral code than that observed by pagans, Christians, especially women, enjoyed a far more secure family life. End quote. And so it was. Christianity's moral demands were actually an asset, not a hindrance. They made the movement more attractive, more effective, and more successful for those who actually joined. Chapter 6. Who would join an intolerant cult? The popularity of intolerance. James Holden quotes David De Silva's comment that, quote, the message about this Christ was incompatible with the most deeply rooted religious ideology of the Gentile world, as well as the more recent message propagated in Roman imperial ideology, end quote. Holding concludes, therefore, that Christianity would have been doomed without something to overcome Roman and even Jewish intolerance, and even more, to overcome a popular distaste for the arrogance and exclusivity of the Christian's monotheistic, uncompromising salvation doctrine. Hyperbole aside, all this is basically correct, and we'll hear later what it actually took to convince people to abandon the most popular ideological assumptions of their day and radicalize themselves, as desperate peoples tend to do, into extreme intolerance. The example of Islam comes to mind. Holding's conclusion does need some tempering, however. First, in terms of number, we already know a large number of Gentiles had long been attracted to the intolerant monotheism of the Jews, and we've demonstrated that Christianity offered all the same goods at considerably less expense. Therefore, even with the stigma of monotheism, we know for a fact Christianity would have been significantly more successful than Judaism already was in winning Gentiles over. Likewise, Christianity's largest gains in its first 100 years came from Jews and their sympathizers, hence the stigma of monotheism had already been overcome within their largest target audience before the Christians even came along. Thus, that stigma was not, in fact, a large difficulty for early Christianity. While other stigmas could be overcome among Jewish audiences with scriptural and moral arguments. Second, as we've already discussed, outside those groups already embracing monotheism, it was precisely because Christianity subverted Roman imperial ideology that it won as many converts as it did. That was a large part of its appeal to the oppressed and disillusioned. Thus, its intolerance in that regard became an asset, not a burden. In the same fashion, it was the increasing failure of popular ideology to meet the needs of Roman communities that Christianity most exploited. And Christian monotheism is the premier example of the brilliance of this marketing strategy. Pagan ideology was an inevitable failure as a consequence of statistics as well as human corruption, and Christian monotheism was the perfect answer as to why. First, statistics. Paganism was largely built on the backbone of what's called votive cult and equivalent practices. The gods were supposed to help people in the here and now by bringing justice, peace, health, prosperity, and fertile fields, and conversely, warding off evil, war, illness, misfortune, and famine. To ensure this, pagan cult involved extensive prayers, rituals, sacrifices, and vows. For example, if you heal my cow, Lord, then I will donate a gold idol to your temple. Since there are no gods, the actual outcome of these efforts is random. Your efforts would fail as often as succeed, and divine rewards would appear to fall on villain and saint alike without regard to merit, which was obviously perceived as capricious and unfair. The pagan system did produce explanations for this. Of course, philosophers like the Epicureans used it as proof the gods don't care at all. But sorcerers claimed to have spells that would get the gods in line for a sizable fee, while holy men blamed these apparently unfair outcomes on all manner of convenient causes, from boons and curses inherited from past lives or ancestors, to some obscure failure of ritual propriety that offended the gods, and so on, which could sometimes be corrected with further rituals. Most people were sufficiently convinced the Epicureans were wrong, since the gods had answered enough prayers to prove they were real and responsive. And the solutions of sorcerers and holy men were statistically guaranteed to work more often than not due to the law of regression to the mean. The gods would become responsive, and when they failed again, a new explanation would be offered, and so on it went. This is a trap of superstitious thinking that has been scientifically demonstrated to ensnare even the rational and well-educated today. Nevertheless, it's easy to see how many would become frustrated by this system. So long as it was the best explanation they had of what was going on, they would stick with it and try to work the system as best they could. But Christians had an alternative explanation. The gods are capricious and fickle because they are evil. They are demonic entities out to exploit you through deception and allurements. They are just teasing you, using you. Instead, if you join our community, who worships the one true God, your benefits will be more tangible, fairly distributed, and consistent, thus proving that ours is the true and only just deity. This was an effective argument, for the evidence bore it out, since the Christian system had actual human mechanisms for effecting and distributing benefits fairly. Therefore, its rate of success was obviously going to be better than chance, and therefore better than all the pagan gods combined. The Christians had a powerful argument on their side. Though we now know this reasoning is fallacious, back then it would have made a lot of sense to a lot of people. Frustrated by the pagan gods, many would find appealing the notion that those gods are perverse, and by offering one supreme deity who is not, the Christians not only explained the pagans' problem, but immediately provided a solution that really appeared to work, especially considering the role miracles played in winning converts, an issue I'll discuss in chapter 13. The way the pagan system worked, since the rate of success and failure from non-existent gods is random, after some failures, a success is bound to appear simply by chance, so a sage or sorcerer will tell the disappointed believer that their string of failures was due to a single cause and then get them working on a solution. As a result, when the believer finally gets the inevitable success from repeated trying, it will appear as if the sage or sorcerer were right. But in contrast, though Christian prayers for the recovery of a sick Christian will also fail from time to time, they will appear to succeed more often than non-Christian prayers for recovery because the Christian community provides greater help, care, love, and comfort to the sick than the poor, for example, would normally receive otherwise. And these factors increase the rate of recovery among the sick. That we know this difference in recovery rate has natural causes is, of course, why we don't believe God was responsible, but the ancients, especially the poor, were less cognizant of such a fact. Likewise, psychosomatic faith healing, a known natural effect, would have aided the Christian mission by skewing perceptions of the rate of success as being even greater than it really was. For instance, many people think school violence is out of control because they see several mass school shootings like the tragedy at Columbine, yet those people ignore the actual statistics which show that school violence has been and remains in steady decline. In other words, focusing on the sensational gives the false appearance that the general reality aligns with the sensational cases, even when it doesn't. If Christians made a special public show of their faith healing efforts, as the book of Acts seems to imply they often did, for example, look at Acts book 3, they may have simply done a better job than pagan holy men of generating the appearance of sensational success. Pagan holy men did not have a unified affiliation, thus it could appear the Christian affiliation had a special power, since it was deliberately advertised as operating successfully in many people, as exemplified in Acts chapter 8. In contrast, the most traditional sources of faith healing were not openly sensational but private, as in the Asclepiad temples, where healing miracles took place outside public view and thus could not compete on equal terms with Christian sensationalism or propaganda. Second, systemic failure. Besides the obvious statistical anomaly the Christian message exploited, there was the more pervasive fact of systemic injustice. A large element of pagan religion was communal and served the explicit aim of supporting the power structure. To participate in cult was often to engage your devoted effort toward winning the gods' favor for those in power. The idea was that as long as the gods granted good fortune to your leaders, your community would benefit, enjoying peace, justice, and prosperity. Already by the first century, and even more in the second, and far more in the third, as I'll point out in chapter 18, this just wasn't cutting it. The powers that be were certainly seeing lots of good fortune showered upon them, and their cronies and collaborators, by the gods. But the more this happened, the worse things got for everyone else. The more the masses won the gods' favor for the community, the more oppressed, impoverished, and exploited they became, and the more unjust, corrupt, and insolent their leaders became. No doubt this bred widespread discontent. Christianity exploited this fact by explaining it. The powers that be were unknowingly enjoying the benefits of demonic forces, and the common people were only helping them and thus making things worse. Instead, if the leaders would only turn to the one true God, then they would, like us, bring true justice and equity to all. This, too, was a very potent argument. The early Christians were notably more just and egalitarian in the way they organized their own society. And it was an easy step of reason to say that, if those in power acted like these Christians, we would be a lot better off. Since the moral order embraced by the Christians was sold, and would often be perceived, as being a result of the blessing of their God, That was, after all, the pagan expectation. The blessing of the gods was supposed to be evident in a blessed leadership, which only the Christians appeared to have. Pagans would find their argument rather compelling, exactly the opposite of what Holding assumes. Demons and elite corruption. In response to all that, Holding claimed to know of no New Testament text where Christians blame corruption and failure among the elite power structure on the elite's worship of demons, meaning the pagan gods, much less one that connects it to the everyday exploitation of the poor and oppressed. I'm not sure what he means to challenge, though. Is he denying the Christians preached that all pagans worshipped demons? They clearly did preach that. Is he denying the Christians expressed disgust with the moral failures of their society? They clearly preached that, too. So he must be denying the Christians blamed social evils on the deceptive influence of demons. But if we put the first two facts together, we end up with the third, making sense of Paul's point that, quote, if our gospel is hidden, it is hidden in those who are doomed, in whom the god of this age, meaning Satan, has blinded the minds of the unbelieving, so the light of the gospel would not dawn in them. End quote. Since all demons serve Satan, and pagans worship demons, as all pagan gods were, the pagans are therefore blinded by demons. This explains every evil that comes from them, for all unbelievers are, quote, enslaved by those who are in nature not really gods, end quote. And this is certainly what the Christians taught. Jealousy, envy, selfishness, coveting, murder, and strife all come from demons. Look at James 3:14 to 4:7. From whom the pagans seek rewards through sacrifice, 1 Corinthians 10, verses 20 to 21, because they are deceived, 1 Corinthians 12, verses 1 to 2. It's partly for this reason that idolatry is to be shunned, 1 Corinthians 10, verses 6 to 15. At the same time, the leaders of the world war against God because their demons are deceiving them, Revelation 16, verses 13 to 14. So the social system of Babylon will fail on account of these demons, Revelation 18, verses 2 to 6, specifically because of the arrogance, selfishness, and greed the demons inspire in the elite, Revelation 18, verses 7 to 16, through their very demon worship, Revelation 9, verse 20. Greed and avarice are singled out above all, quote, for the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, end quote, 1 Timothy 6, verse 10. And we know selfish greed was the principal fault, causing the elite failure to care for the poor and downtrodden. So as Christians saw it, society was corrupted by idolaters, coveters, and extortioners, 1 Corinthians 5, verse 10. Hence, all among the elite who engage in such injustices are those who worship idols and are doomed, while those who follow the true God will not only be good people, unlike the corrupt among the elite, but will also be saved. The clear implication is that there is a difference in behavior between those animated by God's spirit and those animated by the spirit of this world, in other words, by Satan and his demons, who at present rule the world, from which fact stems every evil, directly or indirectly. Holding claims to know of no New Testament text claiming these things. Here I have adduced dozens. It seems he is either a liar or has never even read his own holy book. The message throughout the New Testament is clear. The corrupt elite worship demons, and from this stems their lust to acquire and extort wealth and deceive and betray others, seeking their own worldly glory instead of the true glory of God. For the idolaters, quote, walk according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the powers of the air, of the spirit that now works in the sons of disobedience, end quote. Ephesians 2, verse 2. In other words, what's wrong with society is that people are following demons. Even as all this transpires according to God's plan, and even as there remain some just men among the elite by God's will, nevertheless, every actual injustice that transpires is ultimately due to the influence and worship of demons rather than the true God. There is no doubt that's what many Christians were preaching. And as I've explained above, that was a very effective way to turn their monotheism into an advantage rather than a barrier to success. Managing the family. Besides the supposed stigma of monotheism, Holding also claims there was some sort of filial intolerance, actual or perceived, that would have prevented Christian recruitment. Quote, Jews and Christians held themselves aloof from public life, he says, and engendered thereby the indignation of their neighbors, end quote. But that's not true. Christians actively engaged the public and were conspicuous in being open to all comers, much more than the Jews. Paul, for example, had no problem dining with Gentiles, and it's clear that mixed marriages between pagans and converts were not unknown in the early Christian communities, while Christians were told, in fact, not to shun those outside the church, even if they are sinners. Though the Christians occasionally engaged a certain degree of necessary secrecy, as many cults did, it cannot be said they were ever aloof or not open to every neighbor. Nor can it even be said, as it was sometimes said against the Jews, that Christians only practiced love and charity among each other. Far from breeding the indignation of their neighbors, Christians struggled in every way they could to win over their neighbors, and even failing that, nevertheless endeavored to be kind and open to them. Social strife did create friction against the Christian mission. As Holding says, quote, Jewish families would feel social pressure to cut off converts and avoid the shame of their conversion, end quote. However, that was only true in those cases where the family didn't follow in a convert's footsteps, which is why Christians recruited heads of household first. Moreover, Christianity appealed most to those who found the Christian family a better deal and thus were willing to give up the family that frustrated, disappointed, or dissatisfied them, and replace it instead with the ideal family the Christian church tried so hard to create in its first century of development. This trade-off was even easier for those who had no strong family connections anymore, such as the great number of widows who flocked to Christianity, as well as slaves and migrants, such as those who were evidently willing to abandon their hometowns to travel with Paul. Three groups that could comprise a major portion of Christianity's early success. Add to them the inevitable many who were discontented with their lives, including their family lives, and early Christianity had quite a sizable base to recruit from. For everyone else, Christians exploited or invented statements by Jesus that lent comfort and rationale to converts who had to give up their family to be saved. Notably, the gospel that most clearly and frequently articulates this argument, Matthew, is the gospel thought most directed at a Jewish audience. Therefore, the Christians were appealing to people in this very predicament with plausible arguments that some would buy, certainly enough to account for Christianity's actual scale of success among Jews in its first 100 years. Those who would actually find themselves in this predicament were those persuaded by the evidence that Christians actually had. I'll talk about that a bit in chapters 7, 13, and 17. Or those who wanted something better, or those for whom the system was failing, but who saw family and social connections as the last thing holding them back. Even so, this was not the usual tactic. According to Acts, most Jewish conversions were of entire families, beginning with the head of household, thus largely bypassing the problem of family strife, as everyone would often simply fall in line with their filioque. And even beyond that tactic, by creating their own social networks, Christians eased the difficulties of social strife, or even reversed them by offering better families than people already had. So any perceived filial intolerance there may have been was no great hindrance to Christianity. A stigma of atheism? Continuing the theme of perceived intolerance hindering Christian success, Holding also says that Jews and Christians alike were accused of atheism. But I'm not aware of any real evidence of that, despite having searched hard to find it. The only sources that ever mention such an accusation against Christians are Christian sources. As far as I know, without exception, all the actual documents from pagans against Christianity attack it for being a superstitio, a vulgar superstition, an excessive fear of God, and obsession with the supernatural, not atheism. The distinction between these two charges is carefully drawn by Plutarch in his treatise On Superstition. Since, as far as I know, those Christians who supposedly responded to the accusation of atheism never mention or respond to the accusation of superstitio, and yet the latter is the only accusation we ever find in pagan sources, never atheism, it seems the most credible explanation for this incongruity is that the Christians were consistently mistaking what their pagan critics were actually arguing. Arguably, no one in early antiquity actually believed the Christians were atheists. Many did believe they held false beliefs about the gods, but that's not the same thing. Likewise, persecution sometimes stemmed from a fear that Christian disrespect for the gods would or did bring ill fortune upon the community, but that's again not the same thing as believing they were atheists, that is, people lacking belief in any god. However, I have not fully examined the evidence on this point, so if anyone is aware of any primary evidence contrary to my observations so far, please let me know. You can reach me through www.richardcarrier.info. The closest thing to an exception I'm aware of is a singular report that Domitian trumped up a charge of atheism as an excuse to punish some family and friends who converted, or were accused of converting, to Judaism. But the context, in both Dio and Suetonius, who doesn't mention atheism but says the charges were trivial, is a list of the unjust deeds of Domitian, and therefore reflects an aberration, not a custom. And at any rate, Christians are not mentioned. Though a very late tradition claimed these Jews were Christians, there is no reliable evidence supporting that legend. Suetonius and Dio certainly knew who Christians were, so they would not have confused them with Jews. Certainly, atheism was not a typical charge actually leveled against the Christians, even if it ever was, and they would have had no difficulty refuting it. They did have to overcome a popular perception that they were following a depraved foreign superstition, but that was mainly an objection raised by the privileged elite, which they raised against many popular cults. It thus can't have been any more a hindrance to Christians than it was to almost any other religion of the era. Such perceptions may have limited their penetration of the ranks of the established elite, but since that's exactly what happened, Holding's argument gains no support here. Which is it, Jews or Judeans? Of course, Jews were successfully recruiting Gentiles anyway, so if they were being accused of atheism or intolerance or superstition, that clearly didn't impair their mission much. And as I've repeatedly pointed out, the Christians would have been even more successful than the Jews, because they made conversion so much easier. Once I pointed this out, Holding tried to change his argument by claiming he meant the Romans and Greeks were prejudiced against people from Judea rather than against members of the Jewish religion. That's absurd, and of course, he presents no evidence to support his new claim. All the evidence we have is of prejudice against the Jewish religion and culture, not against their land of origin. Countless Romans and Greeks were even born in Judea or lived there, and hailing from there was no apparent issue for them or anyone else. Indeed, the Emperor Augustus and Herod the Great, king of Judea, were by all accounts very good friends, and Augustus lavished all manner of goods and honors on Herod and his country, and even passed laws protecting the Jewish religion, proving there was no issue of prejudice for him. Holding can't come up with anything to rebut what I actually said, that prejudice against Jews and Judaism was not universal, and many pagans admired or joined them even despite the perceived intolerance of monotheism. The decrees of Caesar and Augustus protecting the Jewish religion is proof enough of that. The widespread evidence of many Greeks and Romans joining the Jewish faith, adopting Jewish values, worshiping a Jewish god, and revering Jewish heroes and scholars is proof enough of that. Josephus hailed from Judea and was a Jew, and yet was not a victim of prejudice. To the contrary, the Roman authorities took him into their own. Even the Emperor Titus fell in love with the Jewish princess Berenice and put her aside only in response to the prejudice of others. So the fact remains that though there was a prejudice against Jews, this prejudice was not universal enough to prevent the scale of success Christianity actually achieved in the first century. Conclusion. As usual, Holding's point that an alien monotheism was perceived as intolerant and contrary to popular ideology does explain why Christianity wasn't more successful than it was, especially within its first 100 years. But, also as usual, this factor was not universally strong enough to prevent the scale of success Christianity actually enjoyed. To the contrary, the disadvantages that Holding describes were often quite skillfully turned into an advantage and actually contributed to its success. Chapter 7. Was Christianity vulnerable to disproof? Holding next argues that the Gospel authors, most especially Luke, in both his Gospel and the Book of Acts, make so many easily disproved claims that they must have been telling the truth, or else their lies would have been exposed and the entire Christian religion discredited thereby. Logically, so the argument goes, the Christian mission depended on making claims, such as regarding the resurrection of Jesus, that could be easily refuted if they were false. That Christianity succeeded entails their claims were not refuted, which entails they were not false. Therefore, Jesus really rose from the dead, and the evidence at the time was more than enough to prove that. Therefore, we should believe it now. General argument. In the early 2nd century, the historian Tacitus observed, quote, that everything gets exaggerated is typical for any story. All the greatest events are obscure. While some people accept whatever they hear as beyond doubt, others twist the truth into its opposite, and both errors grow over subsequent generations. End quote. This is true even today. Every story is subject to exaggeration. Many people accept what they hear without investigating the facts, or alter the historical record in various ways and for various reasons. And all these problems only get worse as time goes on. Tacitus knew it. Everyone knows this. So it's hard to believe James Holding would try to deny it. False stories succeed and spread all the time, even when diligence could discover the truth. Tacitus warned us not, quote, to prefer the incredible things that get published and readily accepted to the truth uncorrupted by marvels, end quote. He knew fabulous falsehoods were readily accepted by enough people to be passed on, recorded, and believed, and this happened often enough to greatly annoy more careful scholars like Tacitus himself, and yet historians today find some of his own reports dubious. How much worse it must have been for those less careful. There is no ancient history that is entirely accurate and without lies, distortions, or errors. Every qualified historian today agrees with that. It is a universal principle accepted throughout the professional community that no ancient work is infallible. Even the most respected and trusted of historians, Thucydides, Polybius, Arrian, are believed to have reported some false information, especially when it came to private matters witnessed by only a few, and when material was important to an author's personal or dogmatic biases and presuppositions. And the further any ancient author is from these men in explicit methodology, by that much less are they trusted. To claim otherwise, to claim against the widest consensus of experts in the field of ancient history, that any historical source is without misstatement, is an extraordinary claim. It requires extraordinary evidence. Holding provides none. This doesn't mean Luke was necessarily a lousy historian. He was certainly better than average when it came to some details, though even at his best, like all other ancient historians, for each detail, he could only be as reliable as his sources. But on top of that, we know he lied. For instance, his account of Paul's mission and the division it created in the church contradicts Paul's own account in his letter to the Galatians in almost every single detail, and in a way we can discern was deliberate. And if Luke lied about that, he could be lying about anything else. Moreover, Luke cannot be classed with the best historians of his day because he never engages discussions of sources and methods, whereas they did. And that is a major reason why modern historians hold such men as Thucydides and Polybius and Arrian in high esteem. They often discuss where they got their information, how they got their information, and what they did with it. It is their open and candid awareness of the problems posed by writing a critical history that marks them as especially competent. Even lesser historians, like Xenophon, Plutarch, or Suetonius, occasionally mention or discuss their sources or acknowledge the existence of conflicting accounts, and yet Luke doesn't even do that. But despite all that, even if Luke were as honest and reliable as the very best historians of his own day, that would still not be sufficient to carry Holding's point for the resurrection. Holding's argument here not only requires the highly improbable assumption that Luke is infallible, and not importing any assumptions or dogmatic commitments into his reconstruction of